This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Adam Ragusea, in for Anthony Brooks. We're taking a listen back to some of our favorite author interviews this hour. In May, we spoke with Massachusetts District Court Judge Nancy Gertner. Before President Bill Clinton appointed her to the federal bench in 1994, Gertner had built a remarkable career as a legal advocate, defending clients in some of the most high-profile cases of the time.
Judge Gertner officially retired from the federal bench last week. Earlier this year, she published a memoir, In Defense of Women, Memoirs of an Unrepentant Advocate.
Gertner's storied career included defending an anti-war activist on trial for her role in a bank robbery and murder of a Boston police officer. She took on abortion rights cases, defended a woman who'd been sexually molested by her psychiatrist, and another who was tried for the murder of her abusive husband. And she did this at a time when there were few women in a stubbornly male profession.
So here's a question that gets to the heart of how our legal system works. Can a passionate civil rights advocate like Gertner, an ardent feminist and high-profile criminal defense lawyer who made no secret of her liberal views, can someone like that become a fair and effective federal judge? Radio Boston's Anthony Brooks spoke to Nancy Gertner in May to find out.
Thanks so much for coming into Radio Boston.
Thank you.
It's great to have you. So let me start right off and just ask you why you wrote this book. In the preface, you write that being a judge is supposed to be the pinnacle of your career, but you worried that the identity of a judge threatened to obliterate all traces of your earlier identity.
Right. What happened was that after you become a judge, you get introduced as if your life began the day you were sworn in as a judge. And I cared very much about this past and what I had done. It was also the case that as part of the confirmation process, I was supposed to go through all my stories to see what would embarrass the president. So I went through all my stories. I decided that nothing should embarrass the president. But then again, the president was Bill Clinton, and so there was an open question as to whether he could be embarrassed. That was another issue.
You told me just before we came in, went on the air, that you thought you were going to get this book written a lot sooner.
Right. I was waiting to be confirmed for 9 months. And at that point, my practice went to hell in a handbasket because nobody knew what I was going to be. And I was gathering my stories, and then I got confirmed. And then it took 6 years to write the book, and I was essentially judge by day and then writing about this other person whom I no longer was by night. So it took a long time.
Well, there's so much to discuss in this book about the times that you worked as an advocate and a civil rights attorney. We're talking about the sort of the 1970s through the 80s. And I wanted to just start by having you do a reading, if I could.
Sure.
And we talked about this right before. And let me just set it up. This is a reading right at the beginning of the book. You and Sonia Sotomayor were asked to speak to women law students at Yale. And this was back in the late 90s before Sotomayor was appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court. The question the law students wanted to know is how you become a judge. Sotomayor went first, and she said, graduate from a place like Yale with a stellar record, become a prosecutor, work in corporate law, demonstrate in word and deed that you can be neutral, and take great care not to be associated with controversial issues. Then it was your turn, and you said,
it was my turn. I paused. How does one become a judge? I paused again. Yes, you graduate this fine institution with a stellar record. But then, and I paused for effect, ever the trial lawyer, my voice getting louder, the cadence quicker, you represent the first lesbian, feminist, radical, anti-Vietnam War activist accused of killing a police officer you can find. That would be your first major case in prime time. You take every abortion case in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. You speak out on the major hot-button legal issues of the day in successive rallies on the Boston Common or on television or in the editorial pages of the newspapers. You represent defendants of all stripes, from those in political corruption cases to high-profile murder cases. And for the final coup de grace, you marry the legal director of the American Civil Liberties Union in Massachusetts. In short, after doing everything that in this political culture, in this epoch of strident judicial politics, should disqualify you for the position, you become a judge.
That's terrific. And the book moves on from there with some fascinating cases that you were involved in. And I got to say, it evokes a time that has passed as well. What's your point here, though, that there's more than one way to become a judge?
Well, everyone has to move to neutral. We select judges in our late 40s and early 50s. We select them precisely because they have lived. We select them because they know something about the world. Other countries select judges in their 20s. So everybody has to move to neutral. The issue is not where you started, but where you end up. And in my next book, I will talk about how this kind of career actually prepared me to care about the courtroom as a place where rights are asserted and where rights are protected, and a really unique place in the world.
Hmm. I know there's certain things you can't talk about because you're still a judge, but I want to ask you this. How has your sort of your first career as an advocate and a civil rights attorney, how did it affect how you are a judge, how you judge?
Well, it's interesting. First, one of the things about having had a career like this is I knew my biases. I didn't pretend to have been, you know, a potted plant for 20 years and then suddenly become a judge. I knew my biases. And that, first, it made me want to explain what I did, lest anyone think that my past was determining what I was doing. So I wrote more decisions, I think, than many other judges do, in which I would try to explain what I was doing and how it derived from the cases and the law and not from who I was. In addition, I knew what it was like to walk into a courtroom as a powerless advocate, as a woman. I knew what it was like to walk into court with people that representing people that other people reviled. And I understood then how valuable this territory of rights is. I also knew what it was like to appear before unfair judges. I write in the book about how during the Sachs case, the judge met with the prosecutor. This is the anti-war, the woman accused of killing a police officer. The judge met with the prosecutor every day.
But he didn't meet with you.
No.
Which is a stunning breach of protocol.
Right. But so I it's very hard sometimes for me to describe it. I cared desperately for the fairness of this space. And that's what I tried to do.
So let's talk about this first case that really put you on the map. And you referenced it just a moment ago in that reading. This was 1975. This was your first big case defending Susan Sachs. And just for our listeners who might not know, she was an anti-war activist who participated in a 1970 bank robbery in Alston. In that robbery, the tragic result, the shooting of police officer Walter Schroeder, who left 9 children behind, she was on the lam for 5 years. She was apprehended. You took the case. Why?
Well, you understand there wasn't a really major competition. She figured that she was going to be going to jail for the rest of her life. She thought she didn't have a prayer of winning, and it was very important to her that she be represented by a woman. I mean, it was a principled issue. It's almost as if the outcome was less important to her than the process. You understand that in 1975, there were no other women or very few other women criminal defense lawyers. I think the only reason that I couldn't turn her down were two reasons. One is I couldn't admit that I was scared out of my mind. Hmm. One of the things about women, I think, of my generation is somehow we all believed that we were carrying the entire mantle of the movement on our backs. And so if I turned down a case like this, it would somehow redound to the detriment of everyone. In addition, I understood who she was. I was 29. She was 25. We had both been on the New Haven Common years before, involving an anti-war demonstration. I was a legal observer, and she was a participant. So while I disagreed with what she did, I understood how that had happened. And the notion of she was facing life imprisonment. And as I say in the book, I was 29 years old. Life was everything mm-hmm. that we had to look forward to. And I wanted to help. It didn't occur to me for a minute that she wasn't going to be punished in some way. The question was whether we could save her life.
Her life. So the basis of your defense then was?
Well, we really didn't have a defense. that was part of the interesting part about this. This was the government put on its case. The evidence against Susan Sachs actually turned not to be very substantial, except for two letters. One she wrote to her father and one she wrote to her rabbi, essentially confessing to the crime. And we let the Boston community believe that the defense was going to be she did all this for the anti-war movement. And we had the icons of the anti-war movement ready to testify. When the government rested its case, not putting in the two inculpatory letters, because they wanted to do this after we had had this defense, I rested. my case, which was a moment of unbelievable fright. No one had heard of me. If this didn't work, everyone would have assumed it was because Susan took a totally green lawyer. And when we rested our case without these letters coming in, then we watched as the jury initially was 9-3 for acquittal, then 10-2 for acquittal, and then 11-1 for acquittal. So it was craft rather than a defense that did it. And since this was perhaps, I think, my third or fourth trial, you know, it taught me a great many lessons about the criminal justice system.
So just to sort of conclude this story, so it ended in a mistrial. She wasn't retried, and you eventually settled, and she went to jail for...
For 8 years. She had another charge, so she had got really no additional time on the Massachusetts charge. But the broader issue about why I would do this is that our system is based on an adversary system, and it can't be said enough times. That means that everyone, no matter what they've done, has to have as vigorous a defense as we know how, and a vigorous defense to match the vigor of the government. And that's what I was trying to do without resources, not a whole lot of experience, and nothing but sort of grit.
You were also up against a really difficult atmosphere for women at that time, to say the least. And you write a lot about this in the book. You were treated poorly by everyone. You mentioned the judge. You even say you felt shunned or ignored by the man operating the elevator in the courthouse. How difficult was it to push through into this legal world, which was largely dominated by males?
You know, it was very difficult, but I actually think that the seeds of the book were written at this time. I'd go home at night and I would write what I felt because I couldn't talk about it. I couldn't complain about it. I couldn't do anything about it. But I write also about it. It's like the catcher trash talking the batter. That's what walking into the Suffolk Superior Court felt like. Everyone said something. Every effort to make conversation turned into a version of who the hell are you and why are you representing this woman?
You write quite powerfully in the book. It was just like this feeling, this constant message, hey, lady, you don't fit in here.
Right. And it would be, and I suspect that young lawyers feel this today as well. You know, you go in to get the file in the clerk's office and they say, I'm sorry, that's not available. I mean, at every step of the way, minor things turned into major ones.
I'm curious to hear you talk a little bit about these concerns that are expressed about so-called activist judges. And it seems like these are terms that are sort of bandied about. You'll hear conservative criticism of judges who are perceived as liberal, and the other way around, sort of liberal criticisms of judges who are perceived as too conservative. What's the issue here? I mean, is there a danger of judges being too activist? And if so, what is it? Or is this sort of a false debate? What's your view on this?
I think it's an incoherent debate. Mm-hmm. Okay, so first, and it very much feels like whose ox is being gored. Part of the debate is a larger debate about, you know, original intent of the Constitution. And the genius of the Constitution is that it was written broadly, and its words don't interpret themselves. People have to interpret it. And oftentimes what happens is if you disagree with someone's interpretation, then you are labeled an activist. I've actually watched over the past 17 years as this has happened. I mean, when I issued the decision against the FBI, the Boston Globe had a headline that said, fair and meticulous jurist. You know, and then I watched when someone else disagreed, and suddenly it looked very different. So there's an issue about interpretation of words, which we have to interpret. But beyond that, the day-to-day judging is about things that are not the grand constitutional issues. They're about access to the courts and access to juries. And I cared so much about access to the courts.
I want to ask you, Judge Gertner, as a lawyer, you pushed hard to preserve a woman's right to abortion in Massachusetts. You challenged a law signed by Governor Ed King that prohibited the use of state funds for abortions. That was overturned in a landmark ruling. So this leads to sort of a general question about all of these interests that you represent. When it comes to women's rights, whether it's abortion rights, sexual discrimination, progress on raising the glass ceiling, we've come a long way since you started to practice. But how fragile is that progress, and how worried are you that we might slip back?
I'm actually very worried about that. Let me talk about discrimination. The economy has contracted the legal employment force. And I only know this anecdotally, but it appears that the people leaving first are women. And that says something about the fragility of the gains. In addition, I don't think that we've fully come to grips with the relationship between work and family. There's always an article at least once a year from the New York Times which says, why there are no more women at the top, because they don't choose to. Mm. And then you read the article and you see choice. Now, that's very interesting. They feel discriminated against in the firm. There's no support for family. So they're leaving law practice. That doesn't feel choice-like. And they're going to raise their children because that continues to be expected more of women than of men. That doesn't seem like free choice.
So what would be the remedy, the sort of short-term and long-term remedy for that?
Well, it's interesting. One remedy I tried to do as a judge, which was to talk about the issue. And Yale Law Women, for example, once issued a report on the most family-friendly law firms. And they sent it to me, and they were very proud of it. What did the most family-friendly law firms look like? They had 12 and 13% women partners. And I wrote an article called The Revolution of Declining Expectations. I mean, the notion that that was acceptable after 50% of the law school classes were women seemed crazy. So there's a certain amount of moral suasion. And then we have discrimination laws that we have to figure out how to enforce better than we have.
Well, it's a fascinating read, and your career is certainly a fascinating one. And thank you so much for coming in to talk about it, both the book and your career. We're very grateful. That's Nancy Gertner. She's a judge with the U.S. District Court for the District of Massachusetts. She's also author of In Defense of Women, Memoirs of an Unrepentant Advocate.
Anthony spoke to Judge Nancy Gertner in May. Last week, Judge Gertner retired from the bench and will join the faculty of Harvard Law School.
We'll be back after a short break. Up next, the story behind Charlotte's Web and the man who spun it, the legendary E.B. White. Stay with us. I'm Adam Ragusea.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.